The figure we're going to be concerned with today is Walt Whitman, and the theme will be the opening of the field. Walt Whitman, then, as figure, and as theme, the opening of the field. Chateaubriand, as we've already seen, at the end of the 18th century, had said that there was no such thing as American literature. Others were going to echo this statement. Stendhal, for example, at the beginning of the 18th century, was to say that there are no real writers in America. Stendhal, there are no real writers in America. In Germany, there was the same kind of attitude. Lenau, a German writer, was going to say that it would take the voice of a Niagara to awaken intellectual life in the United States. It would take the voice of a Niagara to awaken intellectual life in the United States. Well, in some sense, Walt Whitman is that voice of Niagara. It's not quite true to say, as Chateaubriand and Stendhal and Lenau did, that there was no literary scene in America. There was, in fact. There was an embryonic scene even before the great figures, the great American figures of Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman himself came on the scene. There were literary clubs. There were literary clubs in vogue. I quote their program, for improvement in literature. It was very much a society business and very much a colonial situation. And they were looking to London rather to the American continent. The readers were concerned with literature like Addison and Pope, the basis of a classical English education, if you like, with Shakespeare thrown in more or less as a singer of kings. Addison, Pope, a singer of kings, Shakespeare, and the novels of Richardson, these rather weepy, sentimental, socializing novels of Richardson. That was the literature, and Walt Whitman would have nothing to do with it. He spoke of young fellows who had no more depth in them than skim milk. Young fellows who had no more depth in them than skim milk. There was also poetry of a kind. Poetry of a kind, but again, Whitman refused this kind of thing, this stuff. He referred to it in a very derogatory way as the thin, moribund, and watery, but appallingly extensive nuisance of conventional poetry. The thin, moribund, and watery, but appallingly extensive nuisance of conventional poetry. This was a conventional literature, a conventional social practice. What Whitman wanted, and likewise the great American figures like Emerson and Thoreau, was, to quote Whitman again, something really alive and substantial. Something really alive and substantial. So while groups like the Hartford Wits were continuing to produce what Whitman was to call our current so-called literature, like an endless supply of small coin, he was concerned with new energies and new ideas, new impulses, new movements, a new field of energy, a new field of mental and also physical energy. These ideas, in the first instance, came from Europe. These ideas were coming from Europe, and they were channeled by a Scotsman, Carlyle, Thomas Carlyle, who himself had been very much interested in German Romanticism. And he, if you like, exported the ideas of German Romanticism via Britain to the United States. He was in correspondence with Emerson. And you might say that one of the main sources of the new American literature was this correspondence, this exchange of letters between Thomas Carlyle, the Scotsman in Britain, and Emerson on the eastern seaboard of the United States. Now, these new ideas were okay, let's say romantic, or let's use the word which was preferred in the United States, transcendentalist. These are the new transcendentalist ideas which were largely born in Germany. Now, romanticism, to use the conventional literary term, but in philosophy it's transcendentalism. Romanticism meant a few things, and here are a few of these things it meant. As against the practice of witty and moralistic literature, the kind of literature that I've just evoked, as against the practice of witty and moralistic literature, Romanticism, or this new transcendental movement, meant a stress on the organic principle in living, thinking, and writing. A stress on the organic principle in living, thinking, and writing. Now, put it that way, you could say that it meant a love of nature, but it's much more specific and much more acute, I think, to say the organic principle in living, thinking, and writing. And the idea was no longer to dissociate these things. Living, thinking, and writing were to form a synthesis, a new synthetic whole. So as against witty and moralistic literature then, a stress on the organic principle in living, thinking, and writing. That's the first thing. The second thing it meant was, as against an orthodox church and a godhead, the idea of a divinity, either rationalistic or sentimental, as against that, it meant a pantheistic cosmic creed. Pantheism and cosmism. Vast in conception and sweeping its implications. Beyond the orthodox churches and the conventional ideas of the godhead or divinity. Pantheism and cosmism. It also meant, here's the third point I wish to insist on, because they're all leading to Walt Whitman. The third aspect was that it meant poets who, in the words of Carlyle, the Scotsman mentioned earlier, poets who are capable of shaping new symbols. Shaping new symbols. Now, the word symbol comes from the Greek. It means to throw things together. So it means having a wide spectrum of knowledge and experience and being capable of driving them into a coherence, into a new whole. That's a symbol. A symbol creates a new whole out of heterogeneous material. Poets who, to quote Carlyle again, for whom all objects are as windows through which the philosophic eye looks into infinitude itself. All objects are as windows. Reality, not taken at the level of plain immediate realism, but reality as a window into a vaster space, into infinitude, in Carlyle's vocabulary. It meant also, and this is the fourth point, this is a social aspect, it meant a new interest in community and in people, the way people live together, communities. And even meant the making of socialist and communist experiments. There were many of them in New England, and there were later to be even many more on the West Coast in California. But this was something which was starting up. Socialist and communist experiments of living together in a new way. How can people live together in a richer and more harmonious way? This is the question which is in the air. All this meant, this influx, this importation, if you like, but let's keep the oceanic image, this influx of new ideas, what it meant was that literary America, and America non-literary also, was ready for its aboriginal poet, for its first real native poet. America, as a country, was waiting, if you like, for its spokesman. It was waiting for somebody who could say the new American word, who could speak an American language, not simply an Anglo-colonialist language. And this was very much Walt Whitman's moment. He comes on the scene at exactly this time. In other words, he was, if you like, awaited. The scene was laid for him, if you like, and he came just at the right time. Before going further into Walt Whitman's field, Walt Whitman's world, just a few presentations. First of all, a presentation by Walt Whitman himself, because Walt Whitman was very much his own impresario. You know, he was able to put himself on the scene. And here he is in a short text called A Street Yarn, describing himself. This is Walt Whitman on Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman, he says, the sturdy, self-conscious, microcosmic, prose poetical author of that incongruous hash of mud and gold, leaves of grass. There's a kind of oratorical effect, it's almost like a boxing match, you know. Walt Whitman, the sturdy, self-conscious, microcosmic, prose poetical author of that incongruous hash of mud and gold, leaves of grass. This is Whitman on himself. And of course, he's a waking interest there. This is intriguing. Sturdy. So you have the idea of a sturdy poet. I mean, the idea of the poet was a very kind of genteel character. Here he's using a word like sturdy. Self-conscious, because there is a self thing in Whitman. There's an affirmation of personality as against social boundaries, as against a too stiff sociality. Microcosmic, because he is a kind of representative of the whole macrocosm. Prose poetical, because his poetry looks more like prose than it does verse. An incongruous hash, because leaves of grass did not correspond to any model of what a poetry book should be. It was a hash, a mixture of different things. Striving for a symbol, striving for a new expression. Mud and gold, there were good things in it. There were also pages which are less good. But you get at the gold, and this was leaves of grass. That's Whitman on himself then. Here's another presentation, another portrait if you like. And this is by one of the other great American writers of the time, Henry Thoreau. Henry Thoreau says this. He writes this in a letter to a friend in 1856. And he says, and all his words are important, that Walt Whitman is the most interesting fact to me at present. The ones that are interesting. That Walt Whitman. Sir Whitman. That Walt Whitman is the most interesting fact to me at present. The most interesting fact. He doesn't say the most interesting writer, or the most interesting poet, or even the most interesting mind. He says the most interesting fact. In other words, he's putting Whitman into a general context, into, if you like, even a cosmic context. Whitman is a fact, not only a poet, a writer, or even an intellectual, but a fact. That Walt Whitman is the most interesting fact to me at present. I have just read his second edition, which he gave me, and it has done me more good than any reading for a long time. It has done me more good. This is reading to do someone good, to augment his sensation of life. It has done me more good than any reading for a long time. We ought to rejoice greatly in him. We ought to rejoice greatly in him. And then he says this, he occasionally suggests something a little more than human. He occasionally suggests something a little more than human. If you like, there is a more than personal consciousness, a more than human consciousness in Walt Whitman. There is a, to use a weighted word, a cosmic consciousness. Just a few other presentations, just to see sort of Walt Whitman before our eyes, and the book, the man and the book and the man, they are indissociable. Robert Louis Stevenson, whom you all know already. Robert Louis Stevenson said of Leaves of Grass, this is a book which tumbled the world upside down for me. This book tumbled the world upside down for me. And to move ahead just a little in time, and to give you the presentation of a poet whom we'll be speaking about later, William Carlos Williams, later in our sessions. William Carlos Williams says this about Walt Whitman. Most of the writers, most of the poets we'll be concerned with refer to Walt Whitman at one time or another. He, if you like, is the origin of this new American poetry. Here's William Carlos Williams then. Whitman, a key man to whom I keep returning, to whom I keep returning, was tremendously important in the history of modern poetry. Whitman, a key man to whom I keep returning, was tremendously important in the history of modern poetry. And then he goes on, for God's sake, he broke through the deadness of copied forms. He broke through, it's this breakthrough in Whitman which is important. He broke through the deadness of copied forms. He broke through the deadness of copied forms. And then he goes on, simply developing that. The structure of the old is active. It says no to everything in propaganda and poetry that wants to say yes. The structure of the old is active. It says no to everything in propaganda and poetry that wants to say yes. Whitman broke through that. That was basic and good. That was basic and good. These are obviously positive appraisals by people who admire Walt Whitman from the start. But there were many oppositions. There was much resistance to Walt Whitman's thing. Here's one opposition. Here's one example of resistance. And it comes from John Nicol, a man called John Nicol, who was professor of English literature in the University of Glasgow, Scotland. I'm getting my own back, if you like. And he says this in an article on American literature in the 9th edition of Encyclopedia Britannica, 1875. Here's what John Nicol says. Although this author, on various occasions, displays an uncouth power, his success is in the main owing to the love of novelty, wildness, and even of absurdity, which has infected a considerable class of critics and readers on both sides of the Atlantic. He discards not only rhyme, but all ordinary rhythm. The Leaves of Grass is redeemed by a few grand descriptive passages from absolute barbarism, both of manner and matter. It is a glorification of nature in her most unabashed forms, an audacious protest against all that civilization has done to raise man above the savage state. Now, Walt Whitman loved to read that kind of thing, of course, because he took that in positive terms. And he, in fact, described his poetry as a barbaric yop. He was exactly against a certain kind of civilization and against the literature of that civilization. A barbaric yop, Y-A-W-P, a wild word for a cry. It's a wild cry, a barbaric wild cry. Well, after these presentations, these portrayals, let's try and get into Walt Whitman's world, his context, his field. Walt Whitman liked to think of himself as a Pomanacher. Pomanacher, the word comes from Pomanac, P-A-U-M-A-N-O-K, P-A-U-M-A-N-O-K, which is the Indian name, the Aboriginal name, the Native American name for Long Island. He was born in Long Island, but he liked to refer to it as Pomanok in the Indian language. Just as he liked to refer to New York as Manahata, Manahata, again using the Indian word, to try and get at something archaic, to try and get to a new grounding, a regrounding, if you like, on American soil. It begins then, his writing, his living, his thinking, and his writing begins on the shore of Long Island. He knew that shore, he knew Long Island itself, from north to south and from east to west, from Brooklyn to Montauk Point, all the 100 miles of it. He says, "A Long Island, which I sometimes feel as if I had incorporated, which I sometimes feel as if I had incorporated." There is an identification with the physical landscape, scan landscape. So he would stroll over South Bay, again I quote, "the shores of this bay, winter and summer, and my doings there in early life are woven into leaves of grass." And what he would do as he walked along these shores, he would be listening to, and I quote again, the ceaseless roll of the Atlantic, the ceaseless roll of the Atlantic. And this movement of these waves, the movement of the Atlantic rollers, this is his poetry, this is his versification, this is his prosody. When he was in Brooklyn, he'd go regularly every week to Coney Island. Coney Island at that time was a much less crowded and populous place than it is now. And there again, he would walk up and down the shore, a long, bare, unfrequented shore, which I had all to myself, and where I loved, after bathing, there's always this physical thing, to race up and down the hard sand and declaim Homer or Shakespeare to the surf and seagulls by the hour. So swimming, then walking and running up and down the shore, and then reciting, declaiming Homer and Shakespeare. He speaks of the sound of the belched words of my voice, loose to the eddies of the wind. Belch, again, is a very gut bucket word, a very basic and ordinary word to belch. Faire un borborigme. The sound of the belched words of my voice, loose to the eddies of the wind, the eddies, the sinuous movements of the wind. He loves this idea of sinuous flowing movement. Well, there was the shore, and that's his first mental landscape, if you like, physical and mental landscape. But there was also Broadway. He also loved crowds. In fact, he tended to equate the crowd with the ocean. The crowd moved also, like the sea, waves of people. So he would go to Broadway, and he loved to ride on the top of an omnibus. He had friends among the omnibus drivers, I mean ordinary people, these were his friends, and he would ride on the top of the omnibus down Broadway, looking at, and here I quote again, the hurrying and vast amplitude of those never-ending human currents. The hurrying and vast amplitude of those never-ending human currents. Same image coming up again, this oceanic image. You could talk of oceanic consciousness or oceanic feeling. If it wasn't the Broadway omnibuses, it was the ferries, the New York ferries, Brooklyn ferry. He loved traveling on the ferries, to and fro. I have always had a passion for ferries. To me, they afford inimitable, streaming, never-failing, living poems. The ferry boat in its movement across the rivers was a living poem. Always this, as I say, this wave image, this wave sensation, and this oceanic image. What oceanic eddies underneath the great tides of humanity with ever-shifting currents. There were these scenes then, these areas which he liked to frequent. He also did odd jobs. He had to earn his living, so he did odd jobs. He worked for a while as a schoolmaster, boarding around, as they say, living with the pupils' folks here and there on Long Island. His father was a carpenter, and he worked as carpenter for a while. He liked that because it sort of put him in the light of a kind of Christ figure. You know, Christ also was a carpenter. He worked as a printer, and he wrote a bit, but his early stuff isn't very interesting. Walt Whitman only comes into his own quite late, at 35, between 35 and 40. There he's really coming into his own. So the stuff he wrote earlier is not too interesting. In New York, he would go to the theater, and he especially loved operas. Opera as a kind of synthesis, again. He loved listening to the vast, pure tenor, which he said was identifiable with the creative power itself. And listening to this singing, to these operas and these oratorios, he would imagine untold harmonies, the boundless and unspeakable capacities of that mystery, the human soul, should be filled to the uttermost, and the problem of human cravingness be satisfied and destroyed. The problem of human cravingness, the fundamental human desire. What is it? What are we all after? This is the simple, fundamental question he's asking around his late 20s, early 30s. And these questions, these experiences, these experiments, this moving in oceanic contexts constitute the foreground to Leaves of Grass. This is the long foreground to Leaves of Grass. It was a long foreground. He took his time. He took his time and he enjoyed his space, if you like. After that foreground, let's look at background. I mean, there is a social and cultural background, and probably the most significant aspect of Whitman's background is the religious background. And there is a very strong religious background in Walt Whitman. There's a strong religious background to culture in America from then till now. I mean, from straight Catholics and Episcopalians and Protestants to Unitarians, Mormons, Baptists, Moravians, Dunkers, Shakers, you name it, and we've got it. But in and around New York, the religion, New York, which was originally New Amsterdam, religion was Quaker. And Walt Whitman, who on his mother's side was of Dutch extraction, is deeply immersed in the Dutch and Quaker atmosphere in his young days. Later in life, he was to dress, in fact, in the familiar Quaker costume, a broad-brimmed hat, a very broad-brimmed hat, and gray cloth suit. That's why he was sometimes called the good gray poet, the good gray poet. Now, what Quakerism meant, again, without going into a long discussion of Quakerism, and what it meant with reference to Walt Whitman, it meant these things. It meant a strong disposition to humanitarianism, a humanitarian thing, a love of humanity. Humanitarianism. It meant also a belief in the inner light of intuition, the inner light of intuition, doing away entirely with church ceremony, just as Walt Whitman did away entirely with literary ceremony, if you like. It did away with church ceremony and was only concerned with the inner light of intuition. It meant also, this is the third point, the need to develop in oneself the inner Christ. This is Quaker vocabulary. To develop in oneself the inner Christ. It meant being in tune with the infinite, in harmony, the word's coming in again, with the infinite, personally in tune with the infinite, a kind of expansion of the person towards the infinite. And it also meant, and this is the speech side of it, the talking side of it, the poetic side of it, if you like, it meant speaking out straight from the soul. Speaking out straight from the soul. Around the 1820s in America, there was a very strange character, a Quaker. This man was called Elias Hicks. Elias Hicks. Elias, E-L-I-E-S, Hicks, H-I-C-K-S. He was a Quaker, and he was also a wonder speaker. A wonder speaker. Wonder, W-A-N-D-E-R. And a wonder speaker was a man who simply moved around the country. He wandered around the country, speaking wherever he felt the need to, or whenever he felt the inspiration coming over him. Walt Whitman, by the way, would have liked to have been a wonder speaker. But one of the reasons why he didn't do this kind of thing was that he didn't have a strong enough voice, funnily enough. But he was very much interested in this strange wonder speaker, this weird Quaker, Elias Hicks. Because Elias Hicks was a very extremist Quaker. I mean, the Quakers were already extreme with regard to conventional religion, but Elias Hicks was extreme even within Quakerism. And Elias Hicks went around the States saying really amazing things, which were very hard to swallow for a religious throat, even one that was already used to soul quaking and so on. In 1827 in Philadelphia, for example, Elias Hicks spoke up in these words. He's addressing an ordinary public, and he's saying this. And just listen to the sound of it, because it's very rhetorical. And this rhetorical thing, this oratory thing, is very strong in early American literature. Public speaking was important. Lectures were going on all over the place. And to be able to speak publicly was an important part of the culture. So here's Elias Hicks. The blood of Christ, the blood of Christ, why, my friends, the actual blood of Christ in itself was no more effectual than the blood of bulls and goats. Not a bit more. Not a bit. The blood of Christ, the blood of Christ, why, my friends, the actual blood of Christ in itself was no more effectual than the blood of bulls and goats. Not a bit more. Not a bit. Well, you get the message of that, which is incendiary. I mean, comparing Christ to bulls and goats. And it was innovative also in its way of putting things across. You'll get the same kind of thing in other mystics, but this was America in 1820s, early 1830s. And Walt Whitman is listening. So there is this Quaker background, this extreme Quaker background, and you might, to summarize this aspect of Walt Whitman, you might say that he's a kind of super Quaker. He's a super Quaker, or he's a cosmic Quaker, if you like. So there is this Quaker thing. And then there are these new ideas, which I spoke of earlier, these romantic, transcendentalist ideas. Now, just to point the parallelism between ideas as they were coming across in Emerson, before mentioned, Emerson, E-M-E-R-S-O-N, and Walt Whitman, just let me quote from certain essays of Emerson and certain poems of Whitman, and you'll see the parallel right away. You'll see the almost identification. Here's, for example, Emerson in an essay, The American Scholar, which is one of the seminal texts for American literature. This is America affirming itself as against the colonial culture. Emerson, The American Scholar, another sign of our times, also marked by an analogous political movement, is the new importance given to the single person. The new importance given to the single person. And here's Walt Whitman. One self, I sing, a single, separate person, almost the same vocabulary, a single, separate person, yet utter the word democratic, the word en masse. Here's Emerson again. Although there is no pure transcendentalist, yet the tendency to respect the intuitions and to give them all authority over our experience has deeply colored the conversation and poetry of the present day. And the history of genius and religion in these times, although impure, and as yet not incarnated in any powerful individual, Walt Whitman was to do the incarnation, will be the history of this tendency. And here's Walt Whitman, the latent, eternal, intuitional sense. Quakerism, if you like, allied with transcendentalism, led to Walt Whitman, at least one of his aspects. Here's Emerson again. No law can be sacred to me but that of my own nature. No law can be sacred to me but that of my own nature. And here's Walt Whitman, the best authority, my own soul. Emerson again. Only in our easy, simple, spontaneous action are we strong. Only in our easy, simple, spontaneous action, all these words are important, easy, simple, spontaneous action are we strong. And here's Walt Whitman, spontaneous me, spontaneous me. Emerson, in his essay, another seminal text, The Poet. Emerson, in his essay, the poet is representative. He stands among partial men for the complete man. The poet is representative. He stands among partial men for the complete man. That's what they're concerned with. Not simply a new literature, but a new presentation of humanity. A new presence of the complete man. The poet is representative. He stands among partial men for the complete man. And here's Walt Whitman. The human universe has one complete lover. He speaks in terms of love, rather. The human universe has one complete lover, and that is the greatest poet. A few remarks as to Walt Whitman's style before turning to the poems. As we saw before, Walt Whitman described his poetry as a barbaric yop. And we've seen also the influence of public speaking in his way of looking at things, in his way of saying things. Arno Holz, H-O-L-Z, the German writer, called Whitman the greatest orator in lyricism. The greatest orator in lyricism. Another writer, an American writer, Charles Eliot Norton, said that Whitman was a compound, a mixture of the New England transcendentalist, the American romantic, and the New York rowdy, and the street man of the big American cities. Emerson, aforementioned, said that Lisa Grass was a mixture of, and look at this juxtaposition, a mixture of the New York Herald, you know, the journalese talk, public talk, the New York Herald and the Bhagavad Gita, which is the sacred book, one of the sacred books of India. A mixture then of the New York Herald and the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavat, Bhagavat, Gita, Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. A few more remarks as to style. Emerson said that the new writer in America would use all kinds of vocabulary, from the most ordinary, basic street talk to the most fanciful speech imaginable. The vocabulary of an omniscient man, the complete man, the omniscient man, this is what they're after, the vocabulary of an omniscient man would embrace words and images excluded from polite conversation. What would be base or even obscene to the obscene becomes illustrious, spoken in a new connection of thought. They'll use obscenities, they'll use ordinary, cheap talk, but using it in another context, it'll give it a new light. The meaner the type by which a law is expressed, that's what Emerson is saying. If you have a highly complicated law, if you're capable of expressing it in ordinary speech, then you're really going places. Huh? So neither the higher law in itself, nor the ordinary in itself, but the higher expressed through the ordinary, then you're really getting something which is going to have a public impact. The meaner the type by which a law is expressed, the more pungent it is, and the more lasting in the memories of men. And he even says, Emerson, that a writer will tend to even make a lists of words. And this is what Walt Whitman was doing, making up lists of words which he liked and which he was going to use in his texts. He uses what he calls, and this is Walt Whitman now speaking, substantial words. He's looking for words with richness to them, with guts to them, if you like. Substantial words. So he's going to use ordinary, plain talk of the streets. You'll use expressions like stick by. Shall we stick by each other? Ordinary speech, everyday speech. Slang. You'll use slang. You use the vernacular. You'll also use literary words. You will come across very, very literary words also. Recusant, circumambient, highfalutin words if you like, pretentious words. They're there also. You'll find scientific words, because Walt Whitman is reading all the time, reading magazines, reading books, and imbibing all kinds of heterogeneous knowledge. So you'll find scientific words. You'll find foreign words, very many French words. He loved French. French represented for him movement, revolution, 1789 and so on. Foreign words, ensemble, rapport, to pronounce it the way he pronounced it. Ensemble, rapport, camarado, some vaguely Spanish. You use Quaker vocabulary. The Quakers did not use Roman vocabulary like January, February, March, April, and so on. They would speak of fourth month, January, February, March. April was the fourth month, so they would say fourth month. May is the fifth month. So Walt Whitman will speak of fifth month flowers, flowers in May. But they avoided Roman vocabulary. He used Indian words, as we saw, Indian words like Pomanok, like Manahata, and you use very, very often the names of Indian tribes or Indian place names, which of course stud the whole continent of America. So he's beginning to write, and he has a strange way of composing poems. At one time when he was an old man, a student, wishing to write a book on him, came to interview him and asked Walt Whitman, you know, Mr. Whitman, how do you compose poems? And Walt Whitman sort of scratched his head, you know, and said, I just write a few notes down on a piece of paper, and then I write a few notes down on another bit of paper, then another bit of paper, you know, and I put them all in a drawer. And every now and again, when the drawer's full, I open it and bring out all the bits of paper. And the student says, okay, I see, but what do you do with all the bits of paper then? And he said, it just falls together in place, you know, it just falls together. So the student went away, still not understanding really how it happened. But it does, in fact, fall together. Sometimes it falls together less well. Some of Whitman's long poems are sort of bits, more or less sewn together. But very often they come together in a beautiful kind of kaleidoscopic way, in a beautiful new synthetic way. So there is a form in Whitman, though it may not be obvious, just as there is a tremendous rhythm, although it has nothing to do with conventional prosody. It's an oceanic rhythm. Emerson had said that America was full of tremendous opportunities for literature, that there was a sort of sub-literary, sub-cultural movement already. He had said, for example, that a writer, and a new American writer, could learn from speakers in small towns, stump orators, the sort of spontaneous speakers in a small town, the sort of spontaneous leaders, if you like, who would make a speech. It's possible for a writer to learn things there. He said there was also another kind of sub-literature waiting to be exploited, waiting to inspire a real writer, the journals of Western pioneers, these people who had moved into the new territory, as we saw, and who kept journals sometimes, kept notebooks. This was a possible source of a new literature. These were genuine growths as against our European-type books. There were other examples of this kind of sub-literature waiting to be exploited and expanded. There was a thing, a phenomenon called tall talk. Tall talk, this you found on the flatboats on the canals, or on the ferries at times, but mostly on the flatboats on the canals, the Erie Canal, for example. And this would be simply somebody who, out of the blue, would start to give an extemporary speech extolling his own prowesses, his own powers. This was called tall talk, a kind of extravagant self-aggrandizement. And here's an example of tall talk. And if you like, Whitman is a tall talker in his own way. Here's an example of tall talk from Life on the Mississippi, the steamboats, Life on the Mississippi by Mark Twain. Here's an example then of tall talk. Yee-hoo! I'm the old original iron-jawed, brass-mounted, copper-bellied corpse maker from the wilds of Arkansas. Look at me. I'm the man they call sudden death and general desolation. Sired by a hurricane, damned by an earthquake, half-brother to the cholera, nearly related to the smallpox on the mother's side. Look at me, boys, look at me. I take 19 alligators and a barrel of whiskey for my breakfast when I'm in robust health, and a bushel of rattlesnakes and a dead body when I'm ailing. I split the everlasting rocks with my glands, and I squench the thunder when I speak. Yee-hoo! Stand back and give me room, according to my strength. Blood's my natural drink, and the wails of the dying is music to my ear. Cast your eye on me, gentlemen, and lay low and hold your breath, for I am about to turn myself loose. Well, let's look at Walt Whitman turning himself loose. Let's look at some of these poems. Let me just read one or two, perhaps, as the conclusion to today's lecture, and perhaps we'll begin next week's lecture with these poems, just to keep things whole. Let's just look at the first little section you have in the sheets you have before you. Got it? The first excerpt. The first extract. I myself but write one or two indicative words for the future. I but advance a moment only to wheel and hurry back in the darkness. I am a man who, sauntering along without fully stopping, turns a casual look upon you and then averts his face, leaving it to you to prove and define it, expecting the main things from you. Let me just read it once again. I myself but write one or two indicative words for the future. I but advance a moment only to wheel and hurry back in the darkness. I am a man who, sauntering along without fully stopping, turns a casual look upon you and then averts his face, leaving it to you to prove and define it, expecting the main things from you. Just look at the form of this little extract. Three lines beginning, I. There is this personal affirmation. Then the last two lines, leaving, expecting, present participles. He's inviting into a kind of presence, he's inviting a participation in presence, hence these present participles. Apart from that, in the first line, I myself but write one or two indicative words. There's a kind of unusual, almost pretentious use of vocabulary. Words that indicate. He says that's an indicative word. Another interesting word in this little text is sauntering. Walt Whitman is very much a saunterer. To saunter is to move, taking your time. It probably comes from the French sauter. In other words, it's a kind of non-localized floating about. And very, very much is Walt Whitman a floater. You know, when he swam in the sea, Walt Whitman hardly ever swam. That was took too much exertion. He just let himself float. He said, I have always been a first-class aquatic loafer. An aquatic loafer. There's a kind of whale-like thing in Walt Whitman. You know, he sort of takes it easy and moves in long, undulant movements like a whale. This little text is important too because from the beginning it's obvious that Whitman did not consider that he was finishing something. He was opening something. He was opening possibilities, but he was very, very far from thinking that he had pronounced the last word. He was beginning. He loved this word beginning, to begin, to try something out. Even if you're going to make mistakes, even if you're going to come a cropper, try it out. So he's making an attempt and he's beginning. Nothing definitive or perfect. He's not trying to write something perfect. He's trying to write something opening, inspiring, exciting, inspirating. An opening and a beginning. And he says this in this little text, Poets to Come. Let me just then conclude this lecture today with a third reading of this important, central, seminal text. I myself but write one or two indicative words for the future. I but advance a moment, only to wheel and hurry back in the darkness. I am a man who, sauntering along without fully stopping, turns a casual look upon you and then averts his face, leaving it to you to prove and define it, expecting the main things from you. We'll continue from there next week then with Walt Whitman's poems.